Thank you, Jake, both for that introduction and for making this possible. I'm very, very pleased to be here to talk to you today, and in such a wonderfully named room, which I may mention a little later. What I'm going to do today is to talk to you about the work I've been doing on territory, and particularly the history of the concept of territory over the last decade or so, a book that kept being the next book, and then things kept getting in the way, things kept pushing it to being the next but one book, and that finally now I can genuinely say it is the next book coming out, it is finished, it's under final review at the moment, and should hopefully be out sometime next year. But what I'm going to do in talking about that book and in situating it a little bit in relation to the previous book, Terror and Territory, which was a very political book, which supplanted the historical one for a while, because I felt that all the historical work I was doing on antiquity, on the Middle Ages, people were going to say, what's the point? Why does this matter? What does this actually say to what's going on at the moment? And instead of sort of just writing a single article that did that, I ended up getting distracted for a couple of years in writing a book that tried to show how the historical conceptual work that I'd been doing around territory that is come to fruition in this historical book on territory, why that actually mattered, how it helped, or I hoped that it helped to make sense of what was actually going on in the world at the moment. Now what I'm going to do today is to talk about the relation of Foucault to this historical project. And the two key claims that I want to make and then try and justify in the talk are, firstly, Foucault didn't say very much about territory, and what he does is at best misleading. And secondly, that said, Foucault is extremely useful in thinking about the history of territory. And it's to try to kind of reconcile those two claims that I'm going to try and do in the next 40-45 minutes or so. So it's a reflection, a reflection having written this history of territory about how Foucault has been useful for me in writing it, but how I think that there's a number of things in Foucault's work that are problematic and that we shouldn't take at face value in some of the work that he's been writing. So there's four stages basically to what I'm going to do today. The first one is basically to say, this is what Foucault tells us about territory and this is why I think it's misleading. The second one is to say what I think Foucault does nonetheless provide towards a more adequate history of territory. To say a little bit in the third part about what else might need to be added to this in order to make it work, what other kind of traditions I'm drawing on to do this work. And then finally to say something about the story of the birth of territory as I see it, to outline some contours of the book that I've been working on. Now, Foucault discusses political space in a whole range of places in his work. So politics and space is a theme throughout his writing. He says at one point that space is fundamental in any form of communal life. Space is fundamental in any exercise of power. But the question of territory really only becomes a focus in these two lecture courses, translated into English over the last few years, available in French for about 6 years, where he starts to actually make some claims about those, particularly in the Security Territory Population course, but also in the course in the year afterwards. And one indication of his interest in these questions came a couple of years before that, in his interview with the Marxist geographers of the French journal Erudot in 1976. They're talking about the way that Foucault's work, as they say it, seems to be suffused with spatial metaphors, that Foucault is always using these spatial metaphors, and they say, clearly you're really a geographer. That's basically what you're trying to do in your work. And he says, well, you know, hang on a moment, wait. Territory is, no doubt, a geographical notion, but it's first of all a juridico-political one, the area controlled by a certain kind of power. And then he goes through a number of other so-called spatial metaphors in his work, and he tries to qualify how they might be understood. Field, displacement, domain, soil, horizon, region, and so on. They immediately come back at him and say, well, you know, of course these are linked to these juridical, political, strategic types of questions, but that's not surprising that they're equally geographical and strategic. Geography grew up in the shadow of the military. There's an obvious link between those. Foucault's response seems to me to be helpful because he's talking about how the political strategic works at least two levels, both in inscribing itself on a material soil and within forms of discourse. And I think that gives us some indications of how Foucault will approach the question of territory, things that we can take from Foucault to think about the question of territory. What I've tried to argue elsewhere is that much of the literature on territory within geography and within allied disciplines often sort of collapses it back into political economic categories, effectively the question of land, or it broadens it to political strategic questions, what I've called for a shorthand the question of terrain. And some appropriations of Foucault seem to think that the political strategic is basically what we should take from him in order to supplant kind of a Marxist or historical materialist approach to these questions. It seems to me, though, that while Foucault undoubtedly does offer that, he also offers much more than that. The stress that he's making here on the juridical political means how much emphasis we should put on the question of law, but also in the way that Foucault thinks about power, he's really opening up questions of political techniques more generally. So those four registers for me, the economic, the strategic, the legal, and the technical, taken together and thinking about the relation between them, that's really the way that we should interrogate these political and historical questions, the specificities of the question of territory. But it seems to me that it's when Foucault actually addresses those specificities in relation to territory that he starts to become misleading. In terms of the legal question, Foucault basically sees territory as related only to the question of sovereignty, and sovereignty only in the very specific sense that Foucault gives that in these lectures of this time. So he declares, for instance, that sovereignty is exercised within the boundaries of a territory. Sovereignty is basically inscribed and functions within a territory. The idea of a sovereignty over an unpopulated territory is not only a juridically and politically acceptable idea, but one that is absolutely accepted and primary. Now, Foucault is prepared to complicate this story, and he suggests that the actual exercise of sovereignty is often over the bodies within that political space. And he therefore says that any kind of strict linkage between sovereignty, territory, disciplined bodies, and security and population is a bit crude, but that actually seems to be most in terms of the transition between the second and third of those three pairs, rather than the question of the sovereignty-territory relation. Foucault also equates the notion of territory with the question of feudalism, talking about the way that feudalism structures a territory and that the town, in some sense, is an exception. And he thinks that the ways that the town is governed become the model for how people take things forward in later stages of historical development, different ways of structuring governmental space. So Foucault therefore suggests that the traditional problem of sovereignty, as he characterises it, is either that of conquering new territories or of holding on to already conquered territories. And he basically says this is Machiavelli's problem. This is the thing that motivates Machiavelli's writings. He particularly means the prince here. So we get a sense, it seems to me, even in that, just how vague Foucault's notion of sovereignty actually is. Because the term and the concept of sovereignty in political thought tend to actually be seen as emerging at a later moment in time, particularly with the writings of John Bodin rather than Machiavelli. It's not a terminology that you actually find in Machiavelli's writings. Political rule of various kinds, absolutely. Sovereignty, people tend to qualify as a later historical development. Foucault, though, says that the prince's safety, that was the prince's problem. In the reality of his territorial power, it was the political problem of sovereignty. And he stresses that the key thing that the prince needs to do is to maintain, strengthen, and protect the principality, the thing that he's ruling over. But he says we can't understand that principality in a straightforward sense. He says it's the prince's relation to what he possesses, to the territory he has inherited or acquired. That's the thing that we need to think that the prince is actually working on that is protected. It's the relation to that thing rather than the thing in itself that is the object of what the prince is trying to do, what the prince is trying to protect. What he says, it's not the objective principality, but the relation to that principality. Another quote where he makes exactly the same point. What is to be protected is the principality as the relation of the prince to his subjects and his territory, not directly, immediately, fundamentally, or primarily the territory and inhabitants, i.e. in themselves. So when he says that it's this relation, what he calls this fragile link between the principality and the prince, that's crucial. If we look at the thing that relation is towards, the object of that relation, the fundamental element of that is territory. The fundamental element of the principality that the relation is directed towards is this notion of territory. So he says that the object or the target of power is two things. Firstly, the one hand, territory, and then the inhabitants of that territory. So Machiavelli then marks for Foucault basically the end of an era, the kind of culmination of a particular way of thinking about structuring political rule. He says that this is a period that began in the Middle Ages and goes on to the 16th century, the time of Machiavelli, that sovereignty is exercised not on things, he says, but first of all on a territory and then consequently on the subjects who inhabit it. Territory is the fundamental element of Machiavelli's principality and of the juridical sovereignty as defined by philosophers or legal theorists. And he clarifies this point yet again in the next year's course, The Birth of Biopolitics. What was it that the sovereign, the state, the monarch had a hold on in the previous system? And what was its right to exercise this hold based upon, legitimised, founded? It was things, lands. The king was often, perhaps not always, considered to be the owner of the realm, and it was as such that he could intervene, or at any point or any rate, he owned a domain. Now, Foucault makes a slight slip here where he says that actually this was directed over the question of things, which elsewhere he will say is actually the thing that's the transition into the modern time. But what he's definitely suggesting, even if you take out the slip, is this importance of this question of land to this idea, that lands, perhaps at a large scale, basically work up to this question of territory. But it seems to me that to suggest that lands are territory is certainly questionable, or at best economically reductive. Indeed, it's what it seems to me to be striking about feudalism, and we need to remember that feudalism is a retrospective term used by historians to try to understand a vast range of a whole range of different complicated social, political, economic relations. What we need to remember about feudalism is that while property of land is essential, it's paramount importance in this time, it lacked an articulated concept of territory, and what we would now understand by territory is extremely weak within the feudal period. Now, it's well known that Foucault's understanding of this relation between sovereignty and what he labels territory is distinctively changed by developments that come after this moment, in particular by the emergence of a category of population. And he says that there's a kind of a transition between the kind of pact that you had with your government. In the first instance, he says, basically, you would live within a territory that the borders would be protected. You move to a moment where, basically, your security is something that is the contract between you and the government. That you will be protected from things such as ill health, accident, damage, risk, lack of work, delinquency, natural disasters, these kinds of things. It's a shift in the way that government works towards the people that it's directing its rule towards. Foucault suggests that after Machiavelli, the key problem is no longer that of fixing and demarcating. It's no longer the safety of the prince and his territory, but the security of the population and consequently of those who govern it. Now, he makes an argument here that is basically taking the argument of the order of things, where you see in the transitions between analysis of wealth to economics, from general grammar to linguistics, from natural history to biology, which in that earlier work Foucault had said is the emergence of the category of man, question of the emergence of the human sciences. And here what he basically says is, if you think this through politically, you'll see that what's happening is the emergence of a category of population. So it's a rereading of that earlier analysis, but in a more explicitly political form. So as a result of this development, Foucault suggests that the object of government is transformed, the object of government, as well as the type of rule, the technique of rule that is used over it. He says, one never governs, and the stress being on governs, a state, a territory, or a political structure. Those whom one governs are people, individuals, or groups. A state or a territory might be ruled, it might have sovereign power exercised over it, but not governed. It's not governmental power that's exercised. And one of Foucault's examples to mark this break is a French writer, Galen de la Perrière, in a book called The Miroir Politique, The Political Mirror, from the 16th century. And he quotes the definition that's made right at the beginning of that book, the definition of government in that book, the right disposition of things arranged so as to lead to a suitable end. And Foucault says, now what you see here is something really quite interesting. The definition of government, he says, does not refer to territory in any way. One governs things. Now this, he says, is a complex of men and things. Government, though, is not related to the territory. Foucault says, well, perhaps the qualities of the territory, and he'll talk more about that elsewhere, the qualities of the territory might be important, but territory in itself is not the object of this new transformed mode of rule. Another example is more famous writer Giovanna Botero in his book On the Reason of State. Foucault notes that Botero's work suggests state is a stable dominion over people, and Foucault translates that as a strong or firm rule over people. Foucault again stresses, there's no territorial definition of the state, it is not a territory, it is not a province or a kingdom, it is only people and a strong domination. Now in that Herodot interview, remember, Foucault had described the notion of domain as a juridico-political notion, explicitly pushing the spatial determination of that term behind the legal. So he's again here stressing that legal set of relations rather than any kind of spatial determination. But Foucault's claims about Machiavelli, Botero, de la Perriere actually need a little bit of scrutiny. Foucault claims that Machiavelli's key concern is knowing how a province or a territory that's been acquired through inheritance or that has been acquired through conquest can be held against internal or external rivals. He says the key thing in Machiavelli is preserving the safety of the territory or the safety of the sovereign who rules over the territory. And yet nowhere in Machiavelli's writings do you find the word territory, the word Italian word territorio. It simply is not there in Machiavelli's writings. The political spatial elements of Machiavelli's work, such as they are, and I would actually claim that they're actually pretty minor in a lot of Machiavelli's writings, such as they are, they're actually closer to a more military strategic sense of terrain or an economic notion of land, or an agricultural, perhaps even more than economic, notion of land. What's striking about Machiavelli is that continually he goes out of his way to say that these questions are not the focus of political rule, and it's the question of the relation to people that's the most important part of that. Whatever misleading translations of Machiavelli's key term, lo Stato, might tell us, we should actually understand lo Stato in the way that Machiavelli describes it, where he says right at the beginning of The Prince, lo Stato means dominions that have held or have authority over men. States are dominions holding imperium over men. The key here, it seems, is fairly straightforward. The object of political rule for Machiavelli is men or people. Now, dominium and imperium, I would certainly argue, both in their classical and their medieval senses, have a whole range of spatial connotations. But Foucault usually denies that they do. He continually translates the question of dominium as a term like domination, rather than a question of dominion or domain. If it implies territory, then it should in Botero too. But Foucault in Botero translates it as domain. Rather, it's the primacy of men, the populace, which is crucial, it seems, for Machiavelli, not territory. Territory is not the object of political rule for Machiavelli. In order to make that argument that Foucault's making, he has both a very narrow statist sense of territory and then reads that into Machiavelli, rather than finding any justification in Machiavelli's texts to support that kind of reading. How does this happen? Why does this happen? The most plausible reason that I could give for why Foucault makes that argument is that if you read Machiavelli in French, or if you read Machiavelli in English, the word territory is all over the place. But if you read him in the Italian, there is no word that should be translated as that sense. And territory tends to creep into Machiavelli in other languages in two places. One is that people often translate lo Stato simply as territory. And the other one is that they put in territory as an object of a verb when the verb actually often has no object. So that Machiavelli will use things like that the prince needs to acquire, the prince needs to preserve, the prince needs to sustain. And the translators put territory in as the object of those verbs in order to try to make sense of this. But if you think about lo Stato not simply as the state as we might understand it now, but as status or as standing, then I think you can understand what Machiavelli is trying to do in a way that doesn't mean that his object of political rule is this question of territory. Similarly, it seems to me that Foucault's readings of de la Perriere and Botero can be questioned. De la Perriere is a very strange example for Foucault to have picked. The book Miroir Politique is almost not about politics at all. It's actually about a whole set of relations. You can see why Foucault's interested in it, in the argument that government is something that's not simply over a state, but is about government of a family, of a household, of a relation between men and women, men and children, and so on. That's basically what de la Perriere is working through in that book generally. And while de la Perriere very rarely uses the spatial vocabulary, the overall purpose of the book wouldn't particularly suggest that you think that he should have done. Botero, too, only rarely uses a vocabulary that would suggest a territorial definition. Though it's worth stressing that his book on the reason of state is only one of his three main works, one of which is on the question of the city, and the other one is on the question of the world. And those two books, A Geographical Sensibility, is actually much more apparent. There was a book in French a couple of years ago, in 2009, on Botero, that actually used Foucault to try to argue for a profoundly geographical sensibility in Botero, and that territory was actually extremely important. It seems to me that that pushes it too far the other way, but I think to deny that Botero ever has any kind of geographical spatial sense in terms of the way that he understands what the state is doing, the reason of state and the way that that's directed, also seems to me to be problematic. But have a look at that passage and the quote immediately after the one that Foucault takes from Botero. It seems to me that this is open to exactly the same kind of reading that Foucault's making of Machiavelli. But in Botero, I think there's textual support to sustain it. Botero is saying that reason of state is the knowledge of the means by which such a dominion may be founded, preserved, and extended. That in Botero, those verbs at the end have an object, which is the dominium. It's not simply rule or domination, but it is the very dominion, the domain, that is having those things exercised over. Foucault, I think, is probably right in stressing that de la Perriere and Botero do not have territory as crucial to the determinations of rule. But given that that's also true of nearly all of the thinkers that preceded them, I don't think he should see that as in any sense a kind of a break. It's actually a continuation of a previous problematic in terms of how politics is understood. Now, after those claims about Machiavelli, Botero, and some others, Foucault rarely discusses territory again. He makes this point that the security territory population lectures are actually misnamed. If he was going to come up with a title again, he'd call it History of Governmentality or Security Population Government or something different. Territory kind of gets shunted out of the way fairly quickly in those lectures. In the following year's course on the birth of biopolitics, he also says relatively little. And there are moments where he says things, and I'm going to go through those moments, but they're relatively minor in terms of what he's actually talking about in the rest of the course. Let me just talk about a few of those first. The first of one is when he draws on this text by Giovanni Antonio Palazzo, a text where he says there are four determinations of how we can understand the question of the state. The first one is state is a domain, where the Italian word for this is dominio. The second is that it is a jurisdiction, a set of laws, rules, and customs. But Foucault says that a republic is a particular kind of state, and he goes back to those definitions and he restates them. And when he does that, he does something that I think is quite revealing. First of all, he says that a republic is first of all a domain, a territory. It is then a milieu of jurisdiction, a set of laws, rules, and customs. Well, it seems to me that this is revealing because, first of all, Foucault makes this move between domain and territory, which was a relation he claimed did not hold when he was looking at Botero. It's also interesting because his relation to this question of jurisdiction, the relation of this jurisdiction to the state or the political ruler, is immediately to invoke another spatial term, that is, a milieu of jurisdiction. He then repeats this definition of it as a set of laws, but the key question seems to be, where do those laws apply? The question of a spatial determination of this is important when he talks about the question of the population later on. He says, what is a territory and who are the inhabitants of this territory? So even if we accept that the inhabitants or the population become the object of government, what sets these people apart from those people, these set of laws apart from those laws, is a spatial determination or a limit. Now, there's two indications that are interesting in terms of the broader history. Foucault doesn't go into these in any detail, but they seem to be key questions that are worth interrogating if we're looking at the emergence of the concept of territory. Foucault notes, and like many times in his lectures, he immediately clarifies and says, this is probably a bit crude, and I might need to revise this, I might need to rethink this. But he says, every sovereign becomes emperor in their own kingdom, or at any rate, the main sovereigns are emperors in their kingdom. Europe is fundamentally plural. It is a geographical division, a plurality. This, it seems to me, is extremely important because it suggests this importance of geographical division, the question of plural polities. But the question, the one that needs to be asked if we're going to make any sense of this, is how did this idea of a sovereign being effectively the emperor in their own domain or realm actually emerge? How did this idea that their rule was something that was given a spatial determination and a spatial limit, where did this come from? Well, it has a complicated history, but I think you can trace it back at least to the mid-13th century, where Henri de Bragton had suggested that the king has no equal within his kingdom, that it's within his kingdom that the king has that primacy, that superiority. And the question in a late 13th, early 14th century text that was written on behalf of the French king in his debate with the Pope, that the king in his kingdom and the emperor in the empire are effectively functionally equivalent in terms of their secular power in relation to others. In other words, that the jurisdiction of the emperor would not encroach into the kingdom of France, that the King of France would have that power within France, but not outside the boundaries of France. Now, Foucault argues that the key foundation for the basis of royal power in the Middle Ages was the army, but notes that it is also based on judicial institutions. But it seems to me that we shouldn't understand that judicial institution and the role of the army simply in the way that Foucault does it, in terms of reducing the complex interplay of feudal powers. In other words, a relation from the sort of the national level down to the lower level feudal powers that are within that kingdom, but also in terms of a relation up, in terms of articulating a scope to their power that is not dependent on the gift of the papacy. It's a challenge to papal universalism, the idea that the Pope has power across Europe as a whole. It's an idea that you can concentrate power within geographically determined areas, kingdoms, empires, and so on. And that links to the second of Foucault's indications, which is the question of the politics of time. Foucault says that there is no state or kingdom destined to indefinite repetition in time. Now, Foucault links that to the idea of perpetual peace, but I think that the most important resonance of that within the Middle Ages is actually the division between eternal and temporal power. Eternal power, spiritual power, on the one hand, is the power that the papacy would lay claim to, the power that they would have over people's eternal souls, concern questions around doctrine, sin, ecclesiastical practice. Temporal power, or secular power, on the other hand, is the power over their mortal bodies for the span of their life on this earth. Now, both types of power find their initial articulations in the work of papal theorists, and they traded on the idea of the two swords that Jesus was supposed to have granted to his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. Both of these are said to be in the possession of the church, but only the first, the spiritual power, is for the church to rule directly. The second is supposedly not for the church to rule, to use itself, but rather a kind of power that it has that it needs to delegate to others in order to use. The most obvious example of this is the Crusades. It's not the Pope that sends armies to fight the Crusades, but it's the Pope that blesses the armies of the kings and the emperors that go and fight them on his behalf. In time, it was accepted that that temporal power needed to be divided, that you couldn't have a plurality of temporal power. This idea of the Holy Roman Empire is something that would eventually encompass every soul in Christendom gets abandoned. And you have this idea that you have a temporal a notion of power. Temporal power is this secular power that is not the exclusive exercise from the papacy, but is the thing that the papacy is able to grant, that this can be divided, that you can have many people who have temporal power on behalf of the papacy. This could be kings, emperors, princes, various other people exercising rule. That a temporal distinction between temporal power and eternal power gets recoded as a spatial distinction in terms of the sort of supraterritorial sense of power that you have from the papacy and the individualized, located in particular kingdoms type of power that the kings and the emperors start to have. The exercise of political power then within defined limits, a space or what later becomes a territory. And that last point illustrates the key claim I want to make here in opposition to Foucault. Territory is not a term that is especially helpful in making sense of the Middle Ages, or even thinkers as late as Machiavelli. Crucially, it's not the term that political thinkers use to describe the object of political rule. The word in either its Latin or its Vulgar variants is absent from almost all of the key thinkers of the Middle Ages. It's absent from people like Marcellus of Padua, William of Ockham, and Dante. Aquinas uses it a couple of times to talk about the territorium of churches, in other words, which kind of arable land might be grazed by the sheep belonging to one monastery compared to another monastery. It's understood in the older sense of land surrounding an area, rather than the modern sense of the notion of territory. It's absent from Machiavelli. It's not there in Botero or de la Perrière, but it seems to me that that's hardly surprising. It's not there in the thinkers that come before them. They're a mark of continuity rather than of a break. Foucault later suggests that space, territory, and population are controlled by the police, and it seems to me to be that is a more useful way of thinking about it. Each of those three terms, space, territory, and population, each of them have a history of emergence. The historical record seems to me to suggest that each of them emerged, at least in a recognisably modern sense, at the same historical juncture. Territory emerges, it seems to me, later than Foucault thinks it disappears. Let me say then something about what I find so useful in Foucault's writings to think about these kinds of questions. Foucault seems to me to offer a lot of things that are very helpful in orientating our way around these kinds of questions. This is why I say that what he says is misleading, but he's still nonetheless very useful in thinking about territory. One way that he's useful in this is that even though in those lectures he moves away from a focus on territory, he discusses in some detail the emergence of a range of political techniques. And the techniques which Foucault sees as transformative for making earlier vaguer notions of the people into the modern notion of population actually seem to me to be the same kinds of techniques that are used in making vaguer notions of land or terrain into the modern sense of territory. So all the work that Foucault does on the politics of calculation, on the rise of statistics, on political arithmetic, broader modes of rationality and their political counterparts, all of these seem to me to be helpful in understanding how territory becomes an object of governance in that transformed sense. And in the governmentality lecture, he talks about the way that you can understand a transition between an earlier way of understanding these questions, where a whole range of questions around the fertility of land, population density, average wealth, and so on, are merely variables in relation to the territory. That's the first quote. The second one is this transition time as we move into this later way of thinking about this, where government isn't directly related to territory, but to the complex of men and things, this question of population. And then you have a whole range of secondary things in relation to that that government might be exercised over, one of which is territory in this sense of its particular qualities or its particular kinds of understandings. And he then comes up, I'm not going to read the whole quote here, but he talks about there might actually be a better way of thinking about this in terms of three moments of transition. The first one where you have what he calls a feudal type of territoriality. The second one is the administrative state, where you have a territoriality, he says, that is no longer feudal, but bounded. This is discipline in his understanding. And the third one, where you have territory no longer being the object of this form of governance, but you have rather the mass of the population. And he talks about a very calculative vocabulary, terms like volume, density, extension, and so on. Territory is important, but it's not central to that kind of determination. But it's that language of calculation that seems to me to be so interesting in that transition, in opening up what's going on in terms of the exercise of political techniques. The focus then is on what he calls the things in territory that can be measured. Now, I'm going to skip over a reading of a lecture he gave with architects around some of these questions. What I want to focus on is this point about this relation of the question of calculation as the transition that is emerging at this point, because it seems to me that that's the thing that helps us to understand some of the transitions that are going on in terms of how territory is understood at that later point. So that just as the people become understood as both discrete individuals and their aggregated whole, so too the land they inhabit becomes something that's understood in terms of its geometric rational properties. Territory then, and this reading is a political technology, comprising techniques for measuring land and for controlling terrain, rather than those things in and of themselves as the objects. So Foucault's analysis then helps, it seems to me, to understand what actually happens to these political spaces as they get produced into this modern notion of territory. All of those then allow us some kind of purchase on the sort of political, historical, legal complexities around this notion. Foucault, though, isn't the only person that was helpful for the kind of work that I've tried to do in this project. Ian Hacking's work on the history of probability and statistics is really helpful in terms of some of the techniques and the development of some of these ideas. Those of you that are real Foucault fans may know that Ian Hacking's chapter in the Foucault Effect book is called How Should We Do the History of Statistics, which is a title I borrowed for today's talk because this is destined for the Foucault Effect 2, or the Foucault Effect 20 Years On book, that should be coming out in a couple of years' time. So it's kind of a part tribute to what Hacking's doing, as well as Foucault, in this. But the kind of registers that I'm trying to work through is to think about how territory as a word, concept, and practice, and that the relation between those is something that needs to be grasped historically to make sense of this. Foucauldian genealogy or Foucauldian archaeology, and I think the archaeology is actually quite important in terms of the language issues that I'm trying to work on, is extremely important. The second sort of tradition that's been important in this work is the German tradition of Begriffsgeschichte, or conceptual history. This is work that tries to take political terms, historical, social terms, and to try to trace the history of the concept, of the word, and the relation between the word and the concept. And one of the key figures in that movement, believe it or not, this is actually already translated. I'm going to sort of further translate this quote. What this quote is basically saying is that there needs to be an alternation between the question of which concepts are implied by which words, the question of meaning, and which words are used to denote specific concepts, the question of designation, and that if you do that kind of work of the relation between them, then conceptual history allows you to speak of material history. That said, it seems to me that this work, while really useful on the questions of terminology, is actually very weak on the question of practices, and that with partial exceptions, Otto Brunner and Armin Wolf, this has not been turned towards the question of territory explicitly. The third element of a kind of a methodological work that's gone into this project is what's the so-called Cambridge School of Contextual History. People like Skinner and Pocock and the kind of work that they've done on the history of political thought. Really useful for me in terms of some methodological principles, only tangentially useful in terms of the specific question of territory. What I found really useful in it is its continued insistence on the need to read texts back into the conceptual frames within which they were forged, within which they were generated, and to avoid imposing retrospective concerns on them. That you have to be able to talk about these texts, the arguments they're making, the conceptual tools, the words they're using, in a way that would make sense to the person that wrote that text. It's no use taking a later problematic and trying to impose it on those texts to find out what those texts say about some later question that they would have had no way of relating to. Equally, attempts are continually made in that kind of work to render these things contextually specific. Skinner has a nice line on this. He says, if you only read one half of it, if you don't read the people that these people were responding to, the people that they were working on behalf of, it's like only hearing one side of the case in prosecution. You don't know why they're emphasising these particular things over those particular things. You don't know why they're obsessing so much on this detail rather than that. You don't know why they're using the particular language that they're using. And that all too often the history of political thought is read as these kind of key emblematic figures that are taken through history as if they're in conversation with each other, rather than thinking about the kinds of people that they were actually in conversation with in their works and in their correspondence and so on. So important though as those two approaches are, it does seem to me that the kind of genealogical, archaeological sort of ideas that you can take from Foucault have been extremely useful in terms of working these questions through. I'll put up another long quote from Foucault, which I won't read through in general, but it's about this relation between concrete phenomena and universals. It's about this the idea that you write a history of something as a concept without presupposing that that concept has always existed, and then working on the variants of that concept over time. What I've tried to do in terms of my work on territory is to follow this kind of injunction. I've not written a history of territory in the sense that territory is an ahistorical category which has simply been understood and practiced in different ways and at different times. Territory for me is not a universal. Indeed, actually, although I've devoted so much effort to the question of territory, I don't actually think that territory is all that important in a large number of times and places. I don't think it's that central a category of geography. I don't wish to see all problems through a territorial lens. And it's certainly of fundamental importance in the modern period, but I don't think that historically territory is the key way to understand the relation of politics to place. Rather, what I've tried to do in this work is to take a more general question of the practices that relate politics or power to place, if I can use those terms at the moment, kind of as sort of neutral markers to throw up a problematic rather than saying those are the right words to use, to try and think about that power-place relation out of which, historically, the concept of territory emerges. In other words, to try to write the history of territory is not a case of writing about the Greek understanding of territory, the Roman understanding of territory, the medieval understanding of territory. Rather, it's to try to offer an account of the emergence of a concept out of a complicated, multi-layer set of chronologies, fragments, and aporias. Territory as a concept, as all concepts, has a history, and it's also, of course, one with a geography. So genealogy, and the way that I'm trying to understand it, is a historical interrogation of the conditions of possibility for things to be as they are, seems to me to be really helpful in a whole range of ways. It makes use of the kind of textual and contextual accounts offered by Begriffsgeschichte or the Cambridge School, but is critical of any sense that meaning is reliant solely on authorial intent. It tries to use a whole range of techniques that it should inform the history of ideas, but it pairs them with an analysis of practices and the workings of power. The approach that I try to use is both textual, tracing everything back to the original language, working out which terms are actually being used rather than assuming what terms are being used on the basis of translations, and contextual, where I try and put all of the texts back in their own respective times and places. And it attempts to be political. The Terror and Territory book is the most explicit part of this work that's political. But all of it, in a sense, has been motivated by what Foucault calls a history of the present. Now, I'm conscious, given we started a little late on time, so I don't want to talk about the next part in too much detail, but this is why, at least in aspiration, the Clarence Glacken room is a good place to be to talk about this work. This is the table of contents for the book as it currently stands, and you can see that even though I'm saying that I'm not doing the Greek notion of territory, the Roman notion of territory, those are the historical periods and historical places that I'm often looking at, except that I'm not trying to say that they were talking about territory. They were structuring politics, place in different ways that it seems to me to be important in terms of interrogating, and that out of various strands that come from these moments, something approaching the modern notion of territory starts to emerge at a particular moment of time. Now, if you told me even 5 years ago that over half of the book would be on the Middle Ages, I wouldn't have believed you. It became the dominant part of the book because I genuinely think this is where most of the important developments actually happen. And that was very much led by a sense that I wanted the problems to dictate the material rather than having a defined list of the people that I was going to look at in order to talk about these kind of questions. I ended up going in a number of directions that I never expected to do, and pulling out a number of texts that I would never have thought about in order to try to trace this story. I'm not going to try and talk you through a whole range of the questions and arguments. What I will say is that it seems to me that you have at least two stories that need to be traced. One is the legal sense of the notion of territorium, which takes on a recognisably modern sense of territory sometime in the 14th century, where the Italian jurists are tying the question of jurisdiction to territory in terms of if you have a merchant from one town in another town and they commit a crime, whose law actually applies in that instance? And the jurists are trying to work through this kind of question. But this is not Roman law in its pure form. This is Roman law as lain dormant in the West for many centuries, as rediscovered, as reinterpreted, as recoded, as reworked, and so on, that gets picked up and reread in a new context for new political purposes. It's in the 14th century. But in political theory, that seems to have no real impact until probably around the 16th, 17th century. And it's particularly the German writers. It's not the Hobbes or the Locke or even the Bodin that are the key thinkers in terms of this transition. It's a number of German writers who are trying to sort out the complicated and fractured politics of the Holy Roman Empire. And these are writers such as Andreas Knicken, Johannes Althusius, Theodor Ranking, von Chemnitz, Pufendorf, and Leibniz particularly. Knicken, it seems to me, is the most important of the thinkers of this time, but the ideas receive their most striking definitions, which is why I'm going to focus on these now, in the determinations of Althusius and Leibniz. If you saw this quotation in a 21st century political geography textbook, I think you'd think it's entirely unremarkable. Territory is the territory of the kingdom is the bounded and described place within which the laws of the kingdom are exercised. In 1610, it seems to me to be an extremely important determination, particularly in terms of the vocabulary that's being used to understand that idea. And Leibniz makes some striking definitions about this. Leibniz, of course, much better known as a mathematician, as a philosopher, also a diplomat, also it seems to be an extremely important political theorist. Leibniz is asked by his employer, the Duke of Hanover, in the wake of the Peace of Westphalia, what kind of power do I actually have? And Leibniz writes this incredibly long text, which he then boils down to various shorter versions, to try to clarify this question. And he says, basically, the way to do this is in the wake of the Treaties of Westphalia that ended the 30 Years' War in 1648, you need to distinguish between majesty and sovereignty. Now, previous political thinkers like Bodin had thought majesty and sovereignty were the same thing. Bodin, in his French and Latin versions of his text, uses majestas to translate the sovereignty. Leibniz says, no, actually, you need to draw a distinction between them. Leibniz says that sovereignty is distinct from majesty because majesty is the power of the emperor. Sovereignty belongs to the lower level rulers of the empire. For Leibniz, sovereignty is internal competence and external recognition, but it does not apply. It does not mean that all polities are equal. There can still be a hierarchical model of power. And Leibniz makes this definition, that seems to me a really strikingly modern one, of linking sovereignty to territory. But sovereignty in that more nuanced and particular and specific sense, rather than Foucault's vaguer notion of sovereignty that he finds in the Middle Ages. Leibniz says the sovereign or the potentate is that lord or state who is master of a territory. And that is the first time that I found that explicit determination of the sovereignty-territory relation. I won't talk about the general importance of Leibniz, but let me move to some conclusions so we can have a discussion. In The Birth of Biopolitics, Foucault clarifies his relation to that of state theorists. And he criticises those people that thought his theory of his lack of a theory of the state meant that he cancelled the presence and effect of state mechanisms. He says, actually, and I think he's here responding to Nikos Palamsas, but also Henri Lefebvre and their criticisms of his work. He says, actually, the problem of bringing under state control, of statification, is actually at the heart of the questions I've tried to address. But he says this does not mean I begin from the state in and for itself as a political universal or speak of the essence of the state. And it's that nice phrase that he says, we must avoid a theory of the state as we must forego an indigestible meal. The previous year's course, he'd said, actually, what if we were to rethink the way we answer the question of the state? What if the state were nothing more than a way of governing? What if the state were nothing more than a type of governmentality? And in this course, The Birth of Biopolitics, he fleshes that out in detail. The state is not a universal. The state is not in itself an autonomous source of power. The state is nothing else but the effect, the profile, the mobile shape of a perpetual statification or statifications. Concluding, the state is nothing else but the mobile effect of a regime of multiple governmentalities. Now, if you replace the state in that passage with territory, and statification with territorialization, understanding territory then as a process rather than a product, then I think you have something close to what I've at least attempted to do in this product, in this project. Territory for me is not a universal. Territory is not in itself an autonomous source of power. Territory is nothing else but an effect out of a whole range of processes that produce it and continue to transform and reproduce it. Territory, you might even go so far as to say, is nothing else but the mobile effect of a regime of multiple governmentalities, or what I would actually call, rather than governmentalities, political techniques. And it's the history of that sense of territory that I've attempted to trace. And to develop something along those lines in detail is what I tried to do in Terror and Territory, bringing this up to the present moment, talking about a whole range of different things that were going on in the world at the moment. It also, I think, characterises some of the work that Neil Brenner and I have tried to do with Lefebvre. And its uses and implications also shape the future work where I want to go over the next few years, not so much about the question of territory, but to think about the question of the world. And Foucault suggests that he thinks there are many signs of this appearance of a new form of planetary rationality, of a new calculation on the scale of the world. And in my own future work, which at the moment is under the title of The Space of the World, what I'm trying to do is think about the relation between the politics and geographies of globalisation on the one hand, and philosophies of the world on the other. And Foucault remains a crucial inspiration for that work. But making use of Foucault's historical sensibility and his ability to continually pose great questions does not mean that we should always take his word for the answers. Thank you.